So what the BJP is now trying to do, I suspect, is trying to vow these Pasmanda Muslims from the poor and the lower classes to vote for them, because they've been offering them certain incentives and other benefits, which could sort of give BJP that leverage in getting the Muslim vote as well from these particularly deprived classes in India.
Mr. Razvi, like you said, in the 1990s, we saw the rise of several social movements that gave voice to and a new direction to abolish class or caste-based hierarchy in the Muslim society. So the question is, why have these movements become faint and silent today?
It's an interesting question. Effectively, in Islam or in Muslims, there is supposed to be no caste system. However, there are elitist Muslims, well-off Muslims, educated Muslims, up and down the country from north to the south, east to the west. As you know, India is a huge country with a population of about 1.4 billion. So in that, you would have some wealthy Muslims. What has happened, sadly, if you like, is that some of the very wealthy Muslims themselves, whether they live in New Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai, Hyderabad, Calcutta, they have tended to actually turn a blind eye to their own Muslim brethren at times.
Before we let you go, sir, the BJP government has decided to enter the Muslim question not from the top but from the bottom, through Dalits, OBCs and tribals. So what are the effects of this strategy on the unity of Muslims in India?
Well, that's a very difficult question. One would have to really see what happens at the elections, but I'm sure they will make some inroads into the poor community because, as I said, the other backward classes, the OBCs, if you like, and Muslims, some of the poor Muslims fall in that category. Therefore, the incentives and the sweetness that are being offered to poorer Muslims, if you like, will sway some of them to vote. But I think the strategy in the medium to long term, but in the short term, it may be effective. But I think medium to long term, the Muslim political elite will realize that it's in their interest also to be working together with their less well-off Muslim brethren, Muslim community, so that they are not swayed by BJP at this moment.
There you have it, Mr. Shabir Razvi, a political commentator from London. It's always good to have you with us, Mr. Razvi. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Relatively orderly posted, Rajnath Singh reaches out to Muslims, says BJP ready to apologize for past mistakes. Pallavi Ghosh says, will Muslims vote for the BJP in 2024 as BJP reaches out to them?
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In early October, Bangladesh suffered from a grid failure that triggered a blackout across 75 to 80% of the country. This latest development is a mere indicator of the looming power crisis in Bangladesh, where long power cuts and load shedding have become common occurrences. The intermittent electricity supply has impacted key export industries, which are crucial for bringing in much-needed foreign exchange. This crisis also threatens to push Bangladesh into a cycle where it will be unable to secure enough energy imports due to a shortage of foreign reserves, having long-standing strategic implications with its energy partners.
A combination of global and domestic factors has led Bangladesh to the present crisis. Close to 85% of the nation's electricity is generated using fossil fuel like natural gas and oil, with the former being the primary source. An exponential rise in oil and gas prices due to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the decision by the OPEC Plus to reduce oil output, and the European Union's sanctions on the Russian energy sector has resulted in surging inflation and unsustainable energy import bills. Thus, Bangladesh has also been compelled to stop gas purchases and shut down its several diesel-run power plants. Dhaka's scant attention to renewable energy and policies like capacity payments has exacerbated the energy crisis there. Until recently, Bangladesh was the fastest-growing economy in the region. A core part of its success has been the ready-made garments industry, which makes up more than 10% of its GDP and employs around 4.5 million people. Today, Bangladesh is the world's second-largest garments exporter, and the RMG sector accounts for 84% of its exports, playing a crucial role in the country's foreign reserves. However, the current crisis has slowed down the industry, with many factories reporting a fall-off in production by 50%. Daily power outages lasting around 3 hours on average have been one of the main contributors to this trend.
For Bangladesh, the current scenario is as much a challenge as it's an opportunity. Each of its key energy partners comes with a caveat. With Russia, it's the possibility of further attracting Western pressure, unpredictability, and rising costs of doing business. Reliance on China raises questions about reliability, an unsustainable debt, and also disrupts the brewing relationship with India and the US. Undoubtedly, the US comes with expertise and financial capabilities, but lacks commitments, and therefore is not yet capable of countering Russian and Chinese cooperation with Dhaka. Finally, despite technical and financial limitations, India comes with the potential for energy connectivity and trade.
Dhaka faces an uphill task of securing additional gas supplies, rapidly diversifying electricity mix to meet its green energy pledges, and continuing the dynamic economic growth. Shift towards prioritizing long-term energy security requires a careful balancing act of great powers and Bangladesh's key energy partners, who more often than not are at odds with one another. China and Russia have traditionally been vital partners for Bangladesh's energy sector. Today, 90% of the energy projects in Bangladesh's pipeline are funded by China. On the other hand, Moscow has helped Bangladesh with gas exploration and drilling. It has also extended nuclear cooperation by building Bangladesh's first power plant. China and Russia's increasing energy cooperation with Dhaka have compelled the United States to step up its cooperation to be a credible energy partner for Dhaka and counter its reliance on Russia and China. Acknowledging the growing extra-regional footprint in Bangladesh, India is also ramping up its energy cooperation with Dhaka. Revitalized dialogue channels within Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, and Nepal for regional cooperation in energy can provide Bangladesh access to cheap and clean energy from Nepal and Bhutan as well. This cooperation allows Bangladesh a long-term solution for its growing power demand and could help reduce its reliance on fossil fuels by tapping the vast hydropower potential of the neighboring Himalayan nations.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Jahangir Mohammed. He's a director for Center for Muslim Affairs from Manchester. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Mohammed. Now, for Bangladesh, the current scenario is as much a challenge as it's an opportunity. How can Dhaka use the situation, balancing act of great powers and Bangladesh's key energy partners, who more often than not are at odds with one another?
Yeah, I think the issue that Bangladesh has is a short term and a long term one, and you know that in the short term, like in other parts of the world, the energy crisis is going to be very difficult and challenging, as you say, to deal with, because of the increase in prices. The capacity of Bangladesh has been really the fact that they don't have enough reserves to pay for the extra cost rise that's taken place around the world. And they've been dependent on mainly Russia and China for their gas and Qatar for their needs, both petrol and also the gas mainly. And this has meant that really the West is sanctioning those two countries, and therefore supply has decreased, demand is still there, and prices have gone up. So this is a difficult environment for them to navigate. It means they have to look elsewhere as well.
Mr. Mohammed, until recently, Bangladesh was the fastest growing economy in the region. What are the main effects of Bangladesh energy crises can have on the regional economy?
Well, obviously, the demand for energy is still the same and increasing, but the supply of energy has been reduced, and that means that the cost has also increased. And for countries with a fragile sort of balance of reserves in their accounts, it means that they're having to pay a lot more to buy the energy that they need for the country, and that means their reserves are plummeting, which affects their whole economic situation. And secondly, of course, if you're having load shedding and power cuts during the day a number of times, then the capacity of business and local people to continue their economic life is affected. So naturally, growth will be affected.
Mr. Mohammed, for Bangladesh, regional cooperation in energy with Bhutan, India and Nepal can provide it with access to cheap and clean energy. So what factors prevent Dhaka from this cooperation?
Obviously, India is also under pressure not to trade with Russia. So trading and working with India, which leads this regional cooperation effort, also means getting close to Russia. But Bangladesh itself is a major has China as its major trading partner. And particularly in the energy sector, and they have debts to China, loans to China, and of course China and India are economic rivals, but also political enemies over the Kashmir issue and many other issues. India is a part of the alliance with the West, AUKUS and other alliances against China.
Last but not least, Mr. Mohammed, with the winter and a cap on Russian fuel imports approaching, European buyers will look to stock up even more LNG. So what are the consequences of this European action for developing countries like Bangladesh, and what can these countries do to get out of this condition?
Well, obviously the sanctions will remain on Russia and on China as well. Iran is also sanctioned, so you know that's taken out of the market. There's the Europeans are looking for alternative sources for their own supplies, including the United States, which has a lot of LNG, and Qatar, which also does, but that will take a long time, a couple of years to be able to meet the demand from Europe. So not only the developing world, but European countries are also going to suffer in this energy crisis, because supply is going to be restricted and demand is still the same and increasing.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Mohammed for being on the program. He's a director at the Centre for Muslim Affairs in Manchester. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Avex Chemicals India tweeted, Bangladesh needs political willpower because there's high corruption. That's why the country is going through an economic crisis. Bangladesh needs economic reforms if they want to save the nation. India really cares about Bangladesh. Hope Prime Minister Hasina Ji does the same. Lalit Singh Mehta writes, Bangladesh raised petrol prices by 52% in one day. 52% rise. People on streets protesting. Bangladesh going to IMF with begging bowl as economic crisis mounts. Shops locked after 8 p.m. to save energy. 13-hour daily power cut. All expert fans of Bangladesh economy suddenly silent. Sohail Khan says, half a worth reading article. Bangladesh and India grew in past two decades while Pakistan economy didn't grow, mainly due to war on terror, power sector crisis and poor policies. Now as Pakistan has controlled terrorism, inshallah Pakistan will grow and will compete neighbors in 2040.
And that was our episode about the dual policy of the Indian government towards religious minorities and the Bangladesh power crisis and its strategic implications. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son, he's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss questions, issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Today in our studio, we have with us a very special guest, an educationalist, Dr. Ali Alavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for
inviting
me here.
A very warm welcome.
It's a great pleasure for me to be here.
It's an honor to be with you, sir. Well, Dr. Alavi, we have been discussing about the self-confidence in children, and you helped us with the fact that what are the signs that could tell parents that does their child have enough self-confidence or is it lowered? Now you were telling us about the things that lowered the self-confidence in a child.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. We started our discussion with the self-confidence, what is self-confidence, and what are the signs of a kid or a child who has enough self-confidence. Now, slowly, we moved to the factors that actually cause lack of self-confidence or cause self-confidence to be weakened, to get weakened. We talked about the sense of feeling unworthy. That is, the kid automatically, based on his intellect, understand that he actually done something in a lower level in comparison with others or with the other kids at the same age of him.
Yeah.
So he finds and he understands that, okay, there is a poor function that actually brings a sort of, let's say, weak judgment of the parents or the guardians. So we as parents have to be very careful in case our kids are doing something poorly. We should not actually object them or, let's say, contact them very harshly.
Yeah.
So we have to be very cautious in these issues. So you might say it's very difficult to see that every other kid is improving and my own kid is actually lagging behind in some areas. So we have to know that the abilities and capabilities of people are different.
Yeah.
We know that there are some famous scientists that, I mean, they have been even dismissed from the school, but they have done great works in
the
history.
But they have been scientists.
Sorry?
But they have been scientists. Yeah.
I don't know if it is good or not to mention about Einstein, that he was even dismissed from the school sometime, and he had no place to go except the graveyard where her mother was buried there.
Yeah.
You see? So in case we want
We also have Rabindranath Tagore in India, who wrote the national anthem, and he was failed more than 10 times in his 10th class.
Definitely.
So
we have to know, I mean, as parents, about the differences between different age groups, and even in the same age group, we have to know about the capabilities and abilities of different kids and children.
Yeah.
And we should not judge all of them based on one criteria. Let's see, for example, in case he's doing poorly in, let's say, sports, to see, or for example, in football, let's check if he's exactly the same way in let's say, tennis or other, let's say, branches of sports or no.
Yeah.
So these are the questions that we have to actually have in mind and be careful not to act in a way that the kid understand what is in our mind. And he, as I said earlier, he definitely understands what is going on in our minds. I mean, he or she.
All right. So even you're trying to tell us over here that even if you as parents feel like I'm done with my child, I have no hope left now, or you're not able to understand about his next capabilities, you should not show that hopelessness to your children.
Definitely.
Because they understand. Well, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we are talking about self-confidence. So, Dr. Alavi, you were helping us with the things that actually lower the self-confidence in children.
Let's move to second element or factor that I want to mention on what weakens the self-confidence in children is that increased functional pressure. We in our societies, we see usually on the kids or children of 10 and over, usually teachers, parents are expecting even more, let's say, actions or let's say innovations from the kids.
Yeah.
So they try to start comparisons with others. Let's see, I mean, the other kid who is only 12 years old or 2 years younger than you is doing blah, blah, and you are still lagging behind in this single case. As I said earlier, we have to be careful.
Or sometimes there's the reverse case.
Mm-hmm.
Parents actually compare, he's younger than you and he's doing more than you.
Yeah, exactly. The same way, I think this is the same case. Because, I mean, the kid is 14 years old, but, I mean, the subject that he's being compared to is 12 years old, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they said, okay, he's younger than you and he's doing too much thing and you are still lagging behind in this issue. So we have to be, as I said earlier, in comparisons, we have to be very cautious. We have to have too many elements in our minds. Okay, sometimes even you do not compare. You said, okay, you do not compare with any kid as his own or her own age, but you say, okay, this book has been written for a student of, let's say, 12 years old. What's wrong with you that you cannot understand and you can analyze and you can learn whatever is in this book? So actually you're making a comparison with a higher group of students who are, for example, studying. I mean, for a group of students who have 12-year-old, right?
Yeah.
So we have to be cautious. These kind of, let's say, comparisons or analysis, analogies actually destroy the personality of the kid. So on the other hand, we should not, exaggerate on giving too much personification to the student or to the subject to ruin him from the other side. Okay, it's okay. You cannot learn it. It's your right. No problem. The book is, useless. We have to be careful. We have to find some other way to make him interested on that subject or to make him understand that.
Is very, very important that you, at the same time, you're not comparing, and at the same time, you are not telling him that this book or other thing that he's not capable of.
You're not
is
blaming
useless.
The student.
You're
nor
balancing,
the,
basically,
yeah,
things.
Exactly. So, yes, it's true that, for example, maybe the subject was not supposed to start here. So, since last year you had some problem, let's say, in going to school in some certain days, I think this refers to that. I think we have to compensate for that. So, we have to, let's say, take some tuitions or, find some other way to learn this. I think your cousin can learn you, can teach you this part of the book even better than me, because I am not that, professional teacher to teach you or to learn you this part of the lesson or this part of, story, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So these pressures, as I said, usually increase in the ages of 10 and above. So we, as parents, again, we have to be careful. If it is going to start to be damaged and destroyed, I think it will affect the life of the kid in future.
Yeah, we'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned for us.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we're discussing about self-confidence and how we can boost that in children. Well, before we can talk about how we can boost it, Dr. Alavi has helped us a lot to know about how we actually destroy it unconsciously. Dr. Alavi, before going to the break, you told us that it's very, very necessary for parents to create a balance rather than comparing your children. You can introduce a role model, you can tell them different ways how to learn, but not compare.
Yeah, we have been saying that we are going to understand what elements actually strengthen the self-confidence. But since sometimes تعرف الأشلات بعض ضادها, that is, sometimes some issues are we can get some familiarity with some concepts when we know their opposite side. So we started to learn first what actually decreases the self-confidence first. Then, inshallah, we'll focus on, and inshallah.
Yeah, doctors, before curing a disease, try to go back to its causes, what caused this disease, basically.
Definitely. And then, inshallah, we shall focus on the treatment and whatever strengthens the self-confidence.
Yeah.
The next point that I wanted to mention, which is to somehow related to the first two, that is to the feeling unworthy, and second, and the pressure of the increased functional pressure, is the understanding of the dissatisfaction of the parents. When parents actually, as I said earlier, will show their pressure on the kid and their subjects.
And the child will feel like
the
I
child
have
now comes
you.
To feel it, because he will show a sort of change in the behavior of the teacher or the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I told you earlier, the kids or subjects or children, our sons or daughters, are very smart. We should not actually underestimate them.
Yeah.
They are really smart. Yeah, I have many stories about the smartness of the kids in these ages, but since the time actually does not allow us to even focus on those issues, I think I have to ignore and escape those stories. Some of these stories might even change our mindset about what, power our kids even have at the time of breastfeeding, you see? So We said that at this time, they understand the dissatisfaction of the parents from even their facial expressions.
All right.
You see? Then it is directly or indirectly, actually, it affects them in their own souls and in their own spirits. So it causes them to not to accept any risk to enter any, let's say, issue or event. So they'll try to make too many excuses in order to an action. While they are going to draw a painting, I mean, if you ask them, for example, to draw a painting, they might ask too many questions in order to just to escape from that painting itself. Or when you want them to, work on something, since he thinks that there is a possibility of him to be humiliated or to find another, let's say, facial expression from your side, mm-hmm. he or she will try to escape it and leave it for a later time, that even those times will never come.
Yeah.
You see? This satisfaction, we have to be careful. Even we cannot tell lies with our facial expressions. So exactly. What is the solution? What should we do? We should really believe that if our kid is poor in one single aspect, it does not necessarily mean that he is poor in all different
other aspects.
Areas. So this is something quite clear, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has gifted us these abilities. And yeah. For example, he has gifted you, for example, the power in math, and he has, for example, inspired me in learning literature well, and writing poems, right?
Yeah.
You see, so our abilities differ. So we have to know that this kid has some certain abilities, and we have to focus on those abilities and find and have the, the cleverness and smartness of finding those areas of his expertise and the area of his talent.
Yeah.
So this is what parents have to do with consulting with different counselors.
True. I remember a mother who went to a parent-teacher meeting with the hope that my child knows nothing. But after coming out of the parent-teacher meeting, she said, I never knew my son is, he has got different talents. Like, in school, in that meeting, they were told that if your child is lacking in mathematics, just check out his abilities in drawing or painting or other things. And that way, the mother realized, oh, wow, my son is much more talented than I
Definitely.
Ever thought about him. So that's how we actually, we ignore some fields, or maybe we never actually take them into consideration. Thank you so much, Dr. Ali Alavi, for
You're
being
welcome,
with
sister.
Us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن می کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. We all should know that it is the political religious ceremonies that give Muslims, particularly the Shia Muslims, these followers of infallible Imams, the unity they should enjoy. These also preserve the nationality of all Muslims. This political religious testament of mine is not intended for the great nation of Iran only. Rather, it is recommended to all Islamic nations and the oppressed peoples of the world, regardless of their religion or nationality.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, sisters and brothers from all over the world. You're listening to Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Sister Musavi. Well, in this program, we talk on the sentences and valuable expressions of Imam Khomeini on different subjects. One of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi's part of speech about knowledge and the knowledgeable is this: if our country acquires knowledge and culture and learn how to direct knowledge and action, no power can rule over it. This sentence shows the necessity of learning knowledge. There are several messages implied in it, and one is that the victory of a nation can be achieved under the umbrella of knowledge. So knowledge is a pillar for power, and if the government intends to be respected by other nations, it must learn different aspects of knowledge. The knowledge of a nation must be accompanied by culture, which means that working on the cultural aspect of a nation is of utmost importance. These cultural aspects are things like, you know, moral values, social participations, and conventions that are required to be followed in order to give the nation a sense of unity. So, you see that the important theme is that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, does not merely focus on knowledge, but also on other aspects like culture and other things that we're going to talk about after a short break.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi.
Well, one important point, just as Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, rightly mentions, is the direction of knowledge, which is very important and which means that not every type of knowledge is accommodating for the society. As a lover of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, I interpret this sentence in this way, that the best way of directing a field of science or knowledge is to make it useful for people. Such an important hint that Imam is making represents his enlightened view that directs the most effective use of knowledge. Another lesson found in this speech is that in order for a nation to be strong and unbeatable, it must fortify not only its political power, but also other aspects like culture, science, and this is the secret of victory. Well, for closing, let's just repeat the sentence of Imam once more. If our country acquires knowledge and culture and learn how to direct knowledge and action, no power can rule over it.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Economic divide.
It's a concept that has been around for a while, and you probably take it into account when you buy a product by looking for the label, for example, or the color. It's called greenwashing. What is it? Well, that's what we're here to tell you. For even though companies are supposed to comply with green energy commitments, which they use to advertise their products, they're guilty of lying about it. Some of the headlines coming up in this program. First, greenwashing as a whole. What is it? Well, in one sense, marketing as environmentally friendly, but it's also said to be a ploy to make more profits. In essence, a deceitful marketing gimmick is how some describe it. Next up, we will take a look at something that happened recently by the name of the COP27 climate conference. Banks and corporations are said to be lying about their commitments, pledges of net zero emissions, for example, again being false. Then the big question of accountability. Does the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, actually have a game plan? And then greenwashing reality. That's right, scamming the hopelessly naive. Governments are also guilty of this. Scamming taxpayers under the guise of going green.
As the world continues to suffer from a climate crisis in all corners of the globe, concerns are rising over what critics have called greenwashing. The concept refers to a practice through which false information or misleading impression is conveyed about the environment friendliness of a company's products. Greenwashing involves making an unsubstantiated claim to deceive consumers into believing that a company's products are environmentally friendly. The concern was recently raised by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the climate change conference in Egypt.
And today's crisis cannot be an excuse for backsliding or greenwashing. If anything, they are a reason for greater urgency, stronger action, and effective accountability.
Experts believe actors cannot claim to be net zero and at the same time continue to invest in new fossil fuel supply or any kind of environmentally destructive activities. They also cannot claim to be net zero while they are lobbying activities against climate change or just report on one part of their business's assets while hiding the rest. The practice is even more dangerous at state levels. Recently, it was announced that over $340 billion per year by 2030 is needed to prevent Earth's temperature from increasing by 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. For governments and their affiliated businesses, the large amount of money is viewed as a potential source to tap into, while at the same time, they portray themselves as environmentally friendly actors.
When it comes to social media posts, many of the items that we looked at concerned climate change. Of course, greenwashing was mixed in with some of the online media posts, but it's incredible how people feel about this in terms of the focus being that there's not enough being done to actually enforce it. And in other words, for companies to actually comply with the commitment, especially when it comes to the labeling of the packages that is being sold to consumers. All right, first up, this is our first post. The downgrades of ESG funds come as the environmental, social, and governance sector faces growing criticism and accusations of greenwashing, which have prompted investigations by regulators and law enforcement in the U.S. and in Germany. Now, we want to step further, take a look at this and see what it has to say. It said European asset managers are blaming regulatory confusion, the keyword confusion, for downgrade of ESG funds, where Europe's top asset managers are downgrading their ESG funds holdings, in which it's comprised of tens of billions of dollars of client money that had been badged at the highest level of sustainability, but which have come under increasing regulatory scrutiny. The downgrades come as the environmental, social, and governance sector faces growing criticism and accusations of greenwashing, what we just said, and of course that has prompted investigations by regulators and law enforcement in the U.S. and Germany. Have to wait and see what pans out or what comes out of those investigations. Next post, we don't get much water out here. This particular post we took a look because it was interesting in terms of climate crisis as a whole. This says we don't get much water out here. They're going to pollute it. Duranda Shoshone tribe making that claim. 1.7 billion gallons of water depletion per year is planned at the Thacker Pass lithium mine. Next up, just like fossil fuel lobbyists, animal agriculture lobbyists were also present at the COP27 energy that happened that also involved greenwashing, the effects of the meat dairy on the planet. Science is very clear. We need to end animal agriculture and shift to a plant-based food system in order to mitigate the climate crisis. All right, those were some of the posts. Sorry, we picked a couple over there where it kind of swayed a little bit away from greenwashing, but still was under the umbrella of the climate crisis. Let me introduce our guest for this segment of the Q&A. Joining us first is Julia Giordano. She is the ECCO head of international programs. ECCO is an Italian climate change think tank based in Italy. Julia Giordano, welcome to Economic Divide. Please explain to us first what greenwashing actually is. From what we understand is when an organization spends more time and money basically on marketing itself as being, quote, unquote, environmentally friendly than actually minimizing its environmental impact. I mean, it sounds like a deceitful gimmick. What are the gains for companies by doing this? And why not just actually go and do it, be environmentally friendly?
Okay, so yeah, first of all, your definition is pretty much correct. I would say is the attempt to present a product or a strategy as environmentally friendly when it in reality is not. And it's done through, as you said, marketing and communication strategies, but can also be done through other tools, other mechanisms, shortcuts, for example, to present a product, to present something as green, as environmentally friendly, when it's not. The reason is to preserve the status quo, to protect profits, in the kind of like assumption that moving forward towards a more sustainable economy would not be beneficial, which is a big mistake. The reality is that the transition towards, for example, a fossil fuel economy could present enormous opportunities for a sustainable, just, and greater development for many countries.
All right, Joellen Lewis-Russell is an American oceanographer and climate scientist who joins us now. Joellen Russell, welcome. Are there enough laws out there to actually enforce these green commitments or for companies to adhere to these claims that they use, that there's green energy in their production process, do you think?
The more the better. But I also worry a little bit that we're putting a lot of emphasis on what we call adaptation, basically just getting used to being able to handle the very high heat, the very large floods, the coastal inundation, you know, our incredible droughts out here in the West and the wildfires and the emissions. But it would be as a scientist, I'm more interested because I am robot floats and measuring how much carbon's going into the ocean, et cetera. I'm more interested in mitigation.
It's time now for the Info News, a section of the program where we take a look at economic news from around the world. First up, we're going to take a look at Germany and how it's doing overall. It's obviously experiencing lots of problems, and it's affecting living standards. The country's living standards, according to this piece of news, could collapse. This actually was something that a government politician said, that the EU's biggest economy could soon become CO2 neutral, but poor. That's according to a politician by the name of Henning Hohne. He said people need to realize the seriousness of the situation, noting that a number of companies from Lanxess to BASF are ready to invest anywhere but Germany. Of course, that has to deal with the rising energy costs in that country. Next up, let's take a look at cryptocurrencies and see how they're doing. Well, crypto collapse is continuing. This headline read, Betrayed, FTX meltdown signals end to crypto's Wild West days. Cryptocurrency exchange's spectacular collapse has spurred government scrutiny and has called for greater regulation. Now, just to put things in perspective, crypto peaked in November 2021. At that point, investors lost more than $2 trillion up to this point. That's $2 trillion with a T. Okay? All right. This particular topic is very interesting. It's about meatless products. And it says that maybe times are ending for the meatless movement. Beyond Meat, which is a company that produces this, is struggling, and the plant-based meat industry is worrying. A few years ago, business was booming. That growth has slowed, with some wondering if the number of consumers has reached its limit. Now, the debate is whether Beyond Meat's struggles are specific to the company or is it a harbinger of deeper issues in the plant-based meat industry overall. Next up, let's take a look at gold, in particular, China's gold reserves. China has secretly been hoarding gold. Central banks across the world have actually stepped up their gold purchases after Russia's overseas assets were frozen under sanctions this year. Now, the gold-buying frenzy comes as part of fresh attempts by central banks who want to protect their assets by reducing their exposure to the U.S. dollar. And finally, since we're in the World Cup fever, this particular piece of news caught our attention. It's about FIFA and its earnings. FIFA World Cup revenue was up by more than $1 billion. That's right, after taking the tournament to Qatar. Now, the sponsorship was boosted by deals with Qatari companies. Costs were reduced by effectively holding World Cup in one city. So that's the key. Then the earnings from this World Cup cycle are, as a result, $1 billion more than those generated from the 2018 tournament that was held in Russia.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The in-depth section is upon us. Being an ecologically conscious consumer, or green consumer in short, is tough. It feels like there is an endless list of brands that we actually need to avoid. In order to identify misleading ads, the following we have termed the six sins of green washing. All right, first one is called hidden trade-offs. Perhaps the most famous example of this category is organic farming. Organic food is marketed as better for the environment because it eliminates the use of synthetic items, things like pesticides or fertilizers or antibiotics. But the manufacturing process, well, that emits carbon dioxide. That is why it's called the hidden trade-off. Sin number two is called no proof. What does that mean? Well, environmental claims need to be backed by certification and science. Businesses can claim their products are, quote, emissions-free or all-natural without the proof. Many companies are reluctant to publicize their manufacturing process, but when they are making definitive environmental claims, they need to show their work. That's what that means. On to sin number three. This one is pretty obvious about what it means, vagueness, and those are some of the labels there. Terms like green or environmentally friendly or sustainable don't really mean anything. While they imply some environmental benefits, there is no strict standard for what they require. When companies advertise a green product but don't clarify what that means, it's a form of greenwashing. Sin number four, irrelevance. Some environmental claims may be true, but simply don't matter. For example, the sin of irrelevance is aimed at products that advertise an obvious environmental feature. One good example is what's called CFC-free products. CFC are the gases used for various purposes like in solvents or refrigerants or aerosol sprays. They have been banned for over 30 years, but you still see the products advertising that they are CFC-free. Sin number five, the lesser of two evils. Some product categories are just inherently hard on the environment. For example, an SUV may advertise as having 5% lower emissions. Yes, it is better than some alternatives, but that still doesn't make it environmentally friendly. The same goes for gasolines that make such claims. And finally, sin number six, fibbing or lying in short. Here, we're talking about just straight up lying. That's right. A company advertising its products are additive free or contains no harmful chemicals, and it is simply not true. Relatively speaking, this form of greenwashing is fairly rare, according to stats, although that's hard to believe. Manufacturers are more likely to mislead rather than lie. You be the judge on that. Now, in terms of sins by category, let's take a look at the breakdown in terms of the percentages. The sin of hidden trade-off coming in at number one, followed by the sin of no proof at number two. The thing that is ironic is that the sin of fibbing or lying that I just mentioned is in last place. We ask, aren't all of these sins an act of lying? And finally, don't have to go very far to actually find out if the companies are lying. We went straight to the top to get information on that, to the company CEOs. And in a survey that was published of over 1,400 executives across different industries around the world, 58% of the CEOs admitted that their companies were guilty of greenwashing. Among the leaders in the U.S., that figure rose to 68%. Okay, let's bring back our guests to see what they think. Julia Giordano is ECCO Head of International Programs. ECCO, again, a reminder, is an Italian climate change think tank who rejoins us. Julia Giordano, welcome back. You are looking at the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in the COP27 Climate Change Summit or conference. What he said, banks and corporations making pledges of net zero emissions are taking the public for a ride. If everybody knows that, why hasn't the UN as an organization acted on that or not worked with governments to implicate organizations who are guilty of this?
So this is actually what Guterres has been asking, and hopefully this is what it will happen. So last year Guterres highlighted the risks of greenwashing, the risks that many entities can, as I said before, present something as green, as environmentally, as climate aligned, when it's not. So big corporations, financial institutions, and all kind of like non-state actors. So it called for the creation of a committee, of a group of experts, to analyze the situation and present recommendations to such actors on what should be done in order to be defined in line, aligned with the climate objectives. So we are talking about, you know, the alignment to the Paris objective of keeping global warming under 1.5, which is the limit, that if we go over, we have extremely catastrophic consequences for the planet.
All right, Joellen Lewis-Russell rejoins us, an American oceanographer and climate scientist. Joellen Russell, what is the story behind rich people actually admitting that they're or emitting more greenhouse gas emissions than people who are either underprivileged or poor? I mean, is that actually something that's true?
Preventing harm to well-served and rich communities as well as underserved communities. There's no way for a rich person to turn down the sun on super hot days so that their kids can play outdoors. You know, as well as not being able to go in for AC if you're in an underserved community or can't afford air conditioning. These are super important that we address both sides, adaptation and mitigation. And I am pro basically any policy that helps get us there, because like I mentioned, the carbon dioxide hangs out for an incredibly long time, long, long past when we will be here, and the harms are accelerating.
All right. That was Joellen Russell there. It's interesting, though, when you think about it, that rich people actually emit more I guess, CO2 in a sense, and then hence contribute to climate change in that respect. Oxfam came up with a real interesting study on that. Jody Grage rejoins us now. Jody Grage, a member of the Green Party over at the U.S. Jody Grage, welcome back. Greenwashing, just another way of scamming the hopelessly naive, is how it's been described. And it's also been said that governments actually are very guilty of that, who have managed to basically relieve taxpayers of these countless of billions to fill slush funds, as it is said, under the guise of saving the world. Is this an accurate view on this, do you think?